start. So first of all, I need to comment on the exercises. So unfortunately, I was not clear enough, or I didn't tell the right thing in the right place and in the right time. But several people didn't understand. I mean, in particular, because they were just missing when I said this, and that I want the exercises to be handled back before we start the practicals. So, and some people didn't manage to do it in time, and they worry that this, if I don't count them, then it would have a big impact on the end note. And indeed, probably it will, because, as I said, basically the exercises contribute the half of the note, and there are probably not going to be so many because they appear just once in 2 weeks. So I propose that we just count it as a rehearsal and start counting points from the next time on. Hopefully now everyone is up to date with the idea. I also made an announcement at the webpage in red saying that it's before 10 a.m. It's not 12 p.m. It's not anywhere on Earth like tomorrow's 1 a.m. or something. Yes. Yes, I put it at 10 sharp. Yes, I just in case.
Okay, so 10:15 is actually
right. So, okay, and what else concerning the next exercise? It's published. You can look at it. And I really recommend you that you get familiar with it as soon as possible, because, I mean, I'm given to 2 weeks for that, and if you postpone it until the day before the submission, that's probably not going to work, because there are some work to be invested. So if something is unclear, something needs to be commented, please try to ask me about it as soon as possible. And presently, I mean, my goal for today is basically give you enough background for solving this exercise. This is my ambitious goal. So there are two exercises, which, the first and the second, which I hope you can solve already, because, I mean, there is information for that. But the third one is vastly missing the material, and I'm gonna give it today. Right. Another thing I wanted to mention is correct again myself. I claimed erroneously again that this operator for call by value need to have this type. This is too restrictive. Actually, it's sufficient that it has this type. So this A and B need not be the same. I don't know why I made this mistake, but apparently the argument which I gave, why we need it, it applies to this constructor just as well, for the same reason. And I've corrected it on this PDF, in this PDF file which I published on the webpage. Okay. So let's go to the material of the lecture, and as I said, we're gonna reuse the operator, this let operator. And first thing that I propose you to note here is that this P is something of type A bottom, and this F is something of type A to B, where B is a pointed CPO. If you just look how we use this operator, you may notice that, I mean, we used it in the semantic chart for the call by value. But you may notice that we do not use SB just a pointed CPU of a general form, but we use ones of a particular form, namely B equal to C bottom. So every time we use it, not every pointed CPU necessarily has this form, but well, yes, it does have this form, but you would need to prove that it's isomorphic to the things, but we can always give this C. So if you look at the semantic assignments, that this C is always explicit there. So, and this is the first observation. And okay, so what you can get from this observation is if you're just always use this kind of B instead of a generic B, then you can discover yet another unit law. Let unit prime, saying that let x gets p n equal to p. So if we have this, if we assume that b is of this type, then we can use this notation, because this notation always produces something. Right, something like this. And not only you can write this, but you can also prove this identity. So it's also something about the unit. If and the intuitive meaning, if you run a program and bind the result to x, I mean, if you start with the tail, it, you know that you didn't fail until this point. So x is an actual value, which you return here. And this is the same as the original program. So you can prove it just as well, formally. Right. And then that's the first thing. And the second thing is you may look at this construction, this lifting construction, as something more general. You can look at it as a type constructor. So what is a type constructor? It's some functions over types. You receive A, you return A bottom. And I might be interested in other type constructors because I want to play with my notion of computation here. So the notion of computation, which I'm using as a computation, is either value or divergence. But this just suggests me some more general insight about the fact that computation is something more general than a value, which can introduce values. And instead of just this concrete construction, I could use an abstract construction. I could introduce some operator which transforms types. And this leads me to an operator which, just in order not to confuse it with that one, I name differently. I call it do p. Well, let's say f of x. So where the type of p is ta and the type of f is a to tb. That's one thing. And then I also can generalize these brackets. I can call it return. And it goes from A to TA. So if you replace, instead of T, you take this lifting operator, then you would get that constructor with that proviso that that B is always a pointed CPU of that form. So that's the idea. And I can do it more formally. So basically, I can considered as a language. called computational meta language. So we consider a first order version. So for the time being, we forget about all our lambdas and fixed point operators. We just consider a very pedestrian, take a very pedestrian way here. So this notation, by the way, is also called do notation. It's used in Haskell just like this. And a computational meta language is just a system of term construction rule for this operator. So just as before, I introduced types. So I consider A. My generic types AB, B in just some base types, and then my union type, and then product of types, and then TB. So this base is just a I just use some induction basics for this construction. I postulate some collection of base types, and I construct further types within this type system. And what else? Terms in context. So I define terms in context just in the same way as I defined them previously for PCF. So I've got a variable introduction. So x in gamma, let's call it var. And then what? So I can add over signature. Sigma. So I need to postulate a collection of base types, and just as well, I need to postulate a collection of base symbols. So if I have a term and a function symbol from A to B, then I can derive f of t of type B. Let's call it fun. Okay, what else? There is of course this thing. So there is a unique element of the unit type, unit or just star. And then there are pairs. And there are projections. So let me call it pair. So this is actually two rules because I ranges over 1, 2. So right, this is hopefully I didn't forget anything. I forget to say that this F comes from sigma. Because where else it would come from? Okay, and this there's the now the interesting part is this term and this type constructor TB. So I've got two rules for it. One is red, which is simple. If we have this. Then we have that. That's hopefully fits the intuition with the Lifting construction. If we have a value, then we can form a return, and the result is a program. So it has this modified type. Let's call it do. Alright, so this is the framework which is called a computational meta language. It's very simple, but it will enable us to talk substantially about this notion of computation encapsulated in T. So this is clear, isn't it? I mean, I'm using the same practice that I've used for lambda calculus. So I'm having this free variable, it's in context, and I bind the result of executing P to X. So, and then I feed this X into Q, which removes X from the context because it's now bound. It's shadowed by this binder. Right. So, and what we're going to do next is we want to consider this generalization and vary this T type constructor. So we know already several instances. So basically, we want to give a semantics of this language. So we want to define what this thing is in general. And we can already say what this is because we have given the similar semantic for PCF. So we know how to interpret like functions and application and projections, but we do not know how to interpret T. And as the possible candidates of T, I already have, I need to define the semantics of a type. So one candidate is like this one. So this is the one from which we started. And another candidate is, for example, lists. So these are brackets for lists from Haskell. What sort of sense it makes? We can consider lists as computations over its elements. So list is a collection of elements, and every element is a value, and a list is a computation which potentially returns one of its elements, like non-deterministically. And that would be a valid candidate for this language. And another candidate would be like TA equal to semantics of A plus 1, or in Haskell terms, this is the same as maybe X. So this X plus 1, which we return here, is a computation which either can return a value or it returns nothing, saying that we don't know. And in mathematical terms, it's a coproduct of X plus 1. And in Haskell terms, it's a maybe type constructor. And we can also consider it as a computation which either returns a result or, well, diverges, you may think. So this is quite similar to this, of course, but it's not the same. So in sets, if we come up with a set theoretic interpretation, the same. Well, okay, it's not the same anyway, because when we defined this thing, we assumed that we have a CPU. So the difference is both constructions you can interpret over CPUs, but here you do not require that this is the bottom element. Okay, so and to do this generically, I need some general notion of what these things are. And these things are monads. So it's a certain notion which I'm going to explain next. And the thing is, I want to give the semantics abstractly. So as you have seen, we need to consider different universes for interpreting programs. So we considered sets, and we considered CPOs. And there are more interesting realms to interpret programs. So the general approach is to consider a category. So we will consider a category. A category will have these examples like sets and CPOs as partial cases. It will contain more examples. So you could make do without without categories, but the point is when you start doing monads, they force you to consider further categories anyway. So you can start with sets, but monads, once you get them into play, they generate new categories. So it's worth it to start from the categories in the first place. So then this is what I'm going to do, and just give some definitions. I'm not going to do it in very depth because we just use the categories as a language, and to be able to speak about the things. And yeah, okay, my primary goal is to make sense of the exercise 3, of course, so I'm going to be even shorter, maybe. Maybe we get back to some details in one of the next lectures. So I need a notion of a category. So a category consists of a collection of objects, which we denote obc. And So the data, which make a category, is a collection of objects and a collection of morphisms. So these are the important guys. And I'm saying collection. Collection is something which suggests to you the idea that it's probably a set. It's not necessarily a set. It's maybe something larger than a set. I'm not going to discuss it in detail, but this collection of object is most likely not a set. It's something bigger. Collection of homomorphism between A and B. This is also the name for it. We call it morphisms. It's also called homomorphisms. So this is most likely a set, but we do not go into details here. The point is, you just need to remember that there is a set. Well, there is a collection of morphism associated to every pair of objects, such that the following properties hold for every A and op C, there is a special morphism which is called ID, for every A, B, C, if F is in home B, C, and G is in home A, B, then there is a morphism which is called a composition. Which belongs to the home set from A to B. And the following axioms hold: ID F equal to F, F ID equal to F, and F G H equal to F G H. All right, so this is the bit lengthy definition, but what it says is something quite elementary. If you just think of the objects as sets, for example, and homomorphism from A to B as functions from A to B, then this becomes very straightforward. It just says trivial things like we have an identity function, and we can compose function, and the composition is associative, and the identity morphism, the identity morphism is the unit of the composition. So, and indeed, sets in this sense are an example of a category. So we use, we also write f from A to B instead of f belongs to home CAB, and we also write home AB without C if we know already what this is. So this is just a convenient notation, and it's also quite suggestive. So we think of it as a function. And examples are indeed, so the first example is sets. That's exactly the place where you can notice that objects are of a category are not a set, because if I include all sets into my collection of objects, then something's not larger than a set, because the set of sets of all sets is not a set. And home AB functions so identity is identity, composition is composition. Another category is CPO, which we have considered already, and this is indeed a category. And it's quite similar to sets. But of course, for homomorphisms, you take something which makes sense in terms of CPOs. So the homomorphisms are continuous functions from A to B, all continuous functions. And again, so identity is identity, composition is composition. So this, of course, to make sure that this is a category, you need to verify certain properties which are easy to verify. Like you need to show that a composition of a continuous function is again a continuous function, which is follows by definition. So it's not for free, but for an example like this, it's more or less straightforward. Then, just for variety, there is a category called rel. So objects of rel are, again, all sets. And homomorphisms of from A to B is equal to so the homomorphisms are just relations between A and B, which are just subsets of the Cartesian product. And so here one can say that ID is actually this relation, and composition R times S is basically the set of all such pairs that X is in A, Y is in, well, Z is in C, and there is Y in B. such that x, y in R and y, z in S. So we can connect two relations by finding a point z which connects them, a point y. So this is a category which we didn't consider before, but as we will see, it arises by using monads. So we can start from sets, and we can consider a certain monad over sets, and it would generate this category. So yet another category of this sort, well, how to put it, let's call it pfun. That's a category of partial functions. So objects of pfun are again all sets. And homomorphism from A to B . Okay, so I didn't detail the rest. Partial functions means that they are not defined for every argument. For certain arguments, the result is undefined. Then you must, of course, say how the composition is defined. And yeah, so exercise. Right, commutative diagrams. So commutative diagrams, it's not a big deal. It's basically we often want to create big compositions of morphisms. And instead of just writing it down as a string, we can paint them. And this is very convenient. Like there was this, there were these two axioms for composition, for associativity, no, for ID is a unit, so I can draw a diagram like this. So this is my ID, and this is my function f from A to B. Right, so it's the same. So I'm saying that this diagram, when I say that this diagram commutes, it means that between each two points, the composition of the functions which I find on the way from in getting from one point to the other doesn't depend on the path I'm going. So there are two paths between A and B. So on one way I've got a composition of A and ID. On the other way I just have f. So commutativity of this diagram means that f composed with ID is equal to ID. So, in other ways, way, I could just write it down as an equation. So we often use commutative diagrams just for this purpose, for writing equations, because they are more pictorial. So, but there is no big deal about them. Is it clear so far? Including those who doesn't attend the category seminar. Okay, so the next thing is back to the language we want to make sense of. It features, apart from the types, and I think maybe you can guess already that we want to interpret types as objects of a category. So because an object is a concept which replaces sets or CPOs, so it's a generalization of them. And we interpreted previously types as CPOs, and now we just want to interpret them as objects and and function symbols as morphisms. What next? So we've got the structure for the Cartesian products. So what's the categorical way of talking about it? So in category theory, we do not construct things. We instead specify things. So we just, sets, we construct a product. We say explicitly it's a set of pairs, etc. In category theory, we cannot do it because we do not have a notion of an element. So we can only specify these things. We can describe a product is such a thing that, and we want to make this definition correct in the sense that if we vary the category, it instantiates to different things, and all the things make sense uniformly. So hence my definition. So a product of objects A and B in the category C is an object A times B . So this is the notation. At this point I didn't know anything about A and B and how it's structured. I'm just saying that such a thing exists, and I'm using this notation for it. So I postulate the morphisms. So in set theory, we have them as a consequence. We define a coproduct, and then we define we derive these projection functions. And here I do the other way around because I don't know how it's constructed. So I just specify my product, saying that it's the one which supports these two operations. And for any C, okay, so that's supposed to be like Romain C, and this is supposed to be calligraphic C. Imagine that I can distinguish them. F goes from C to A, and G goes from C to B. So there is a unique morphism which is generated by these two morphisms, and we use a special notation for it, the one which is familiar. Such that this diagram commutes. And this diagram commutes, as you can see, means that this triangle commutes and this triangle commutes. So F is equal to the composition of PR1 with the pair. Unique. Yeah, I said that it's unique. So this triangle also commutes. So G is equal to this composition. So as a text, so you can write this as kind of axioms. PR1 composed with FG is equal to F, and PR2 is equal to G. So I just mentioned two examples which are straightforward. I mean, you certainly knew this already. The thing is, we used it as a property, but now it's used as a definition. The point is, it's good as a definition. That's the non-trivial part of it, because I'm just specifying thing, but you can actually prove that such a thing is well defined in the sense that this product is unique up to isomorphism. I'm not stating this and I'm not proving this because I don't want to say what an isomorphism is, for the time being at least, but just informally, the correctness of this definition is justified by the fact that it correctly defines this thing. It describes it, but it describes it in a unique way. Okay, my next definition is then, that's a simple thing, terminal object. So it's an object which for which we have a special notation, 1. There is a unique morphism again, not a big deal. You can see that as such an element in sets, we have a singleton set. So indeed, for every set, there is a unique map to a one element set, because it's a map which maps everything to that element. And also in this example, you can see that the terminal object is not uniquely defined, because there are many singleton sets, but they are all isomorphic. So, and that's the notation that's often used, exclamation mark A, and this A is often omitted because, well, this notation is superfluous. So we got A to 1. Then you already know what this A is, so this is often omitted, just like by identity morphisms. So, and now having got this, we can define what we call Cartesian category. Okay, just write it like this. So a Cartesian product is a category where we have a terminal object and products. So meaning that the product exists for every two objects. And examples are again the same ones. Examples, sets, CPOs. Because we can form this structure in sets and CPOs, and actually we have done it when we, well, for sets it's known, and for CPOs we went through this when we defined the semantics of CPO. So the next thing is as functors. Thank you. So a functor is a correspondence which, well, a rule. Again, I'm trying to avoid the terms like function, because function is something from set to set, and this is something more general. So it acts on the, okay, that was wrong, obviously. So this is f of a, of course. So it takes an object of the original category to an object of the target category. So it's like a function from C to D. But C and D, they have structure. And function preserves the structure. So it takes objects to objects, and it takes morphisms to morphisms. But it takes morphisms to morphisms in such a way that it's coherent with the source and the target. So if we have a morphism f from A to B, then our functor takes it to f of A to f of B. Okay, in such a way that, then finish it, f of id A is equal to id f of A, and f of the composition, as you might expect, is the composition of the images. So we want to preserve our identity morphism, and we want to preserve the composition. So I give two examples. One example is forgetful functor. So forgetful functor is a general concept, but I give just one instance of it. In our case, in the case I want to explain, it's a functor from CPO to set, such that f of A is equal to A, well, and f of F is equal to F. Of course, this is not exactly an identity transformation, because I apply F to a CPO, but in the end I get a set. So this A and this A's are different in the sense that this is I know how to write it in a smart way. F of A approximation, so this is the notation we used for a CPO. This is just A. Okay, and for F, it's just F. So I forget about the fact that my set was ordered, yes? Yes. And this works because every continuous function is a function. And every CPO is a set. So I forget the information that I don't want, and the rest remains. And another functor example so here's my another example So the next example which I'm going to give is is a functor from set to set. It's sometimes called an endofunctor because it's a functor to the same category. And I define f of x equal to x plus e. So this is the disjoint union. We have this. We had this at the exercises already. So it's a disjoint union. Since I'm at sets, I can form disjoint union. So it's fine. And f of f, so what is f of f? It's, let's say, I say briefly what my a is. My a is a function from a to b. So my f of f must be of type x plus a to x plus b. So I apply it to, I must basically provide a value, well, a function which consumes either a value, either an argument of type x or an argument of type e. So I just define it by two clauses. Inl x, so if it's inl x, then I just run my function. And wrap it under inl. Don't have enough room here. And inner e is just equal to inner e. And this is how you would do it in Haskell. So to define a function with this as an argument, you need to define it on the left side and on the right side. And then you can verify the properties. So there are these two axioms of functors. They are easy to check. Ah, okay, I have yet another example, I think. Let me mention yet another one example. F of, let's just consider sets, but it would work not only over sets. So f of x is given let's say finite list. It's a bit different than Haskell. So in Haskell, list can be infinite, but let's just stick to finite ones. So I say that f of x is the lists, and f of f is equal to, okay, so how I define my action, I need to say how this works over a list. So, and this is very easy to do. I have a list from 1 to n. And to tell what's the action of this functor, of this transform function on the list, I just say that I define my f to every component. Right? So this sort of examples, like this one and that ones, they you can understand in terms of data structures. So this f, it constructs lists, and this constructs like this sort of objects. You can again define them in Haskell. So and basically. The argument is the type of the elements, and the result is the type of the obtained structure, like lists. I can just the same way I can define trees. Finally, so I introduce monads. a monad, okay, in the category C, as given by a triple T, eta, and star. So I just indicate that this is an operator which sends its argument to something. So these triples are also called Kleist triples. Where T is some correspondence between objects of the category . So eta is a morphism. Eta is a family of morphisms from x to tx, indexed by this object x. And for any f from a to tb, f star goes from T TB. It's also called lifting. And eta is called unit. So you see maybe that it's similar to our previous constructions with this lifting of domains. So this analog of this unit is again this brackets, which lift from a CPO to a point at CPO, and this star is again the star which we used to define the LED constructor. And the following laws are satisfied. So there are three laws which this operation satisfies in conjunction. Eta is equal to id, and f star eta is equal to f, and f star g is equal to f. So there are three laws. They again correspond to those LED laws. So I enumerated the laws for the LED. So there was one associativity law and two unit laws. And the second unit law I introduced today. And this essentially the laws which correspond to them. And given such a semantic thing, I hope that it's a correct thing to interpret my meta language, because it provides the necessary structure for it. And there is yet another example then. So I have time just for one example only. So again, I'm just considering this functor like before, and I showed that this is a monad. So sometimes you just say t is a monad. Yes. Is it all right? So we said that a monad is a triple, but sometimes you you omit these two components because you just assume them. So and say that T is a monad, meaning that you know how these remaining things are defined. So and I claim that this is a monad under eta of x defined in such a way that eta of A is what NL A, right? And F star. So I define it by case distinction again. So if I have NL, then I just apply my function. And if I'm at inner, then I so this is supposed to be E. So I lift my function. My function was like this from x to y plus e, and I lifted it in such a way that I also defined it for the additional clause where I've got e. So if I'm on this branch, then this is f of a. So if I'm on this branch, so then I just call the original function f. And if I'm on the right branch, then I output this e. And the behavior of this construction, it resembles the use of exceptions. So this monad is called an exception monad, because this object is treated as an exception object, and this definition of f star means how I use this function to handle exceptions. So I need to extend this function over an object x plus e, which means x plus e means either I have x or I have an exception. So, and if I have an exception, this definition tells me, okay, if you have an exception, then output exception. And if it was not exception, then you can run the function, which was the original f. I hopefully can show you how this works in Haskell. No. Ah, okay. I wanted to show you this this previous example from the practicals. So we have discussed this this pairs, and someone, probably you, correctly noted that we must have a well order on the pairs, right? Just briefly, it's not a very sensible example, but I mean, it also demonstrates how you do how you create classes. So this type class pair is a class which you can define like this. So it's like you can view it as a functor now. So it's a functor of over two objects. So you can form a Cartesian product and send this Cartesian product. Well, I mean, right. So it's difficult to maybe this is not such a good example after all for a functor because it's precisely the Cartesian product. So and we can say that we derive this act and show basically we automatically make at instances of these two classes, and I could say derive ORT like I proposed, but if you do it and it will automatically derive lexicographic ordering for it. And what I'm doing here is I enforce my own ordering. And of course, it doesn't work well precisely because, as Paul noted, it's meant to be like a total order. So to define, to make it an instance of ORT, I need to define this function, which is total. For every pair, I need to say if it's smaller or it's greater or it's equal. So there's no sort of case where it's undefined. Well, unless I just do it explicitly. But if I do it explicitly like this, then I would fail every time I would call this function to something which cannot be compared. So I can run this program. Run Haskell pairs. And you see the difference here. So my pairs return false if I try to compare these things because this is strange. I probably defined it wrong. So 2 and 4 must be greater than 1 and 3. At least this is correct because this is lexicographically greater. Yeah, I don't actually know. Ah, yes, that's a mistake. Thank you. And just a copy-paste error. Yeah, then they are, then they agree, but so you can find something. Yeah, at least they would be different in this example where there's a pair which is incomparable, but with a lexicographic ordering, it's always comparable. Anyway, so I mean this is how you do the type classes, and in the same way you do it if you want to talk about things like monads and functors. And so you also define a piece of data. So, like, if you want to define this thing, so the Haskell notation for it is this. So your this is for the left branch. This is for the right branch. And as I well, sketched how it can be made, how it can be shown to be a functor, you can declare it to be an instance of class functor in Haskell 2. So you can say that exception E as an instance of functor, and you do it in precisely the same way as you do it with pen and paper. So you need to tell what the functorial action of this functor is. So given a function, you must tell how your functor converts this function. And this basically just resembles the definition that I've just given in mathematical notation. And of course, you don't need to say how the types are transformed, because this definition already takes care of this. So you need only, when you make it an instance of a functor, you just need to take care of the fact that it transforms the functions correctly. And now I can also make it an instance of type plus monad. So I say that this exception, so this data thing is a monad. And just like I did, you need to implement this unit, so this eta in my nodes, and in Haskell it's called return, and this is just equal to success. Did I define it? Yes, I did define it by left injection. But here you don't need to left inject or right inject, because the left hand branch and the right hand branch are named. So you can use this name success instead of inner and exception as inner. So that's why I don't say inner here, I said just success. And so the Haskell notation for the star is this one. And it has the same type as the one that I showed you. So you need to, given a function like this, which was my f, I need to define a function from a, ma to mb. Or if you uncurry it, then you would just have this type. So, and these clauses are exactly the clauses which I've given. So an exception monad, of course, it would be boring just to have these definitions only, because they only certify that I have a monad. But I want to use this particular monad somehow, and I use it for handling exceptions. So that's why I define additional functions which are specific to these monads. And these functions are throw an exception and catch an exception. So basically, I can generate an entity of the left-hand side, and in throw, and I can use the sketch operator, and if I'm given a computation like this, I can use this function to handle the exception. So if an exception was thrown, I can use this function to catch it. And here I wrote a simple program. I wonder if you can already say what the output of this program will be, some of you. So this program throws an exception and passes the control to this other program, which also throws an exception. So the first program throws an exception 42, the second throws an exception 10. But I catch an exception in this whole bit and handle it with a return statement. The return statement says that the exception that you caught, you return as a value. So what would be intuitively the output here? Yes?
Success.
Yes, exactly. So I do not appeal to your mathematical understanding of it, because you need to do lots of calculations. But I write this program because I need to implement some programming intuition. So if I throw an exception and then I throw another exception, that the one that is returned is the first one, because you don't go further if exception is thrown. This was... Yeah. Right. So I can put this example online, so you can look at it and maybe run it, and compare it with your notes and see how the theory which I just presented crops in. Maybe we will have some exercises about it. Okay? Thank you. This is it.